in the city of Corinth, eating dinner at a pagan temple that included giving honor to an idol was as common as you and I going to dinner together at a restaurant. It was part of the social fabric of the community. The Corinthian Christians wanted to argue that despite the idolatry, which they said they didn't believe in, it was all right to attend these festivals. And so, in chapters 8 through 10 of 1 Corinthians, Paul takes up this question. But Paul, he is a brilliant pastor. He doesn't just make a commandment. He doesn't just say, don't go to idol temples. Instead, he uses the whole question to teach the Corinthians and to teach us how to think about our rights and how living for our rights can be dangerous, not only to others, but to ourselves. In chapter 8, we see the Corinthians decided that since idols have no power and meat is unaffected by the pagan hocus pocus, it's okay to eat. But from here, the Corinthians made a wrong turn. They made a wrong turn in their thinking because they said, if it's not wrong, it's my right. If it's not wrong, it's my right to eat this meat. It's my right to attend these dinners. They didn't consider the impact of their example and their lifestyle on others when they asserted their rights. And so in chapter 9, Paul takes the argument a step further. He says that we should consider our rights in light of the advancement of the gospel. Last week we learned that the gospel advances when we're more concerned with reaching the lost than with protecting our rights. And then we come to our passage, which begins in verse 24. And Paul's argument takes another turn. He makes a very serious warning. Here's the heart of Paul's warning to the Corinthians, and a warning to us. Listen carefully. Your rights can ruin you. Your rights, my rights, they can ruin us. Your rights can ruin you. They can lead you to do much harm to the reputation of God and to His work in this world. So let us read, beginning in verse 24, let us read, let us be sobered. Let us learn. Do you not know that in a race all the runners compete, but only one receives the prize? So, run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the spiritual rock that followed them. And the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in a single day. We must not put Christ to the test as some of them did and were destroyed by serpents, nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, but they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come. Therefore, let anyone who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you, except that which is common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape, that you may be able to endure it. The Corinthian world is not very far from our own. It was not very far from the world of William Wilberforce. I don't know if many of you, I hope most of you, I would encourage all of you to go see the movie Amazing Grace, which is the story of Wilberforce's life. Most people know of Wilberforce as the British politician in the late 18th, early 19th century who led Parliament and the British government to abolish the slave trade and eventually slavery itself. What many people don't know is that Wilberforce's life was fueled by the gospel. He was a Bible-believing Christian, and that is what gave him the motivation to go after slavery in a country where the wealthy of that land could care less about slaves, most of whom were across the ocean. Now, Wilberforce didn't grow up as a likely candidate to abolish slavery. He grew up exceptionally wealthy. He had wealthy parents and relatives. He lived a very easy life. He was trained in how to get along in upper-class society. He partied his way through Cambridge. And upon graduation, on a lark, decided to run for Parliament at age 21. And he won the election. He won the election because he was an outstanding speaker, and because basically he invested a phenomenal amount of money and bought some votes. Well, Wilberforce is in Parliament and life is good and he's enjoying all the benefits of the wealth and the society that he travels in. And then God arrested his soul and he became a Christian. And upon becoming a Christian, he became very concerned for the condition of his soul, especially through the temptations of the society that he lived in. And so he decided he was going to quit politics and retire from the society that he had been a part of all his life. And he went for counsel. He went for counsel with a pastor that he met at his aunt and uncle's house when he was a young boy, a pastor named John Newton, a pastor who had one time been the captain of a slave ship. And he said, "John, I want to retire from politics at the age of 26. And Newton said, "No, don't stay there, because God has raised you up. He's raised you up for a great purpose. He's raised you up to be used to abolish slavery." But this presents Wilberforce with a major problem. How am I going to live in the really wicked society where easy sex and gluttony and gambling and erotically oriented theater is just a way of life? And so he began to make some decisions. One of the things he did, I found this fascinating, he belonged to five social clubs. It's like belonging to five country clubs. Quit them all in a day. He said, "I can't handle this." People were afraid for him. People thought, "Wilberforce, you are risking political suicide by withdrawing like this." He stopped going to the theater. He changed many habits. Why would he do this? He had rights to all these things. Well, Wilberforce did this because he did not want to misrepresent the gospel. And as importantly, he was aware of his own vulnerability to fail. He faced the same social challenges the Corinthians did, and he excelled where they failed. Now, our passage today makes the same claim on us as it did on Member of Parliament William Wilberforce, as it did on our Corinthian brothers and sisters. And here is Paul's point. We must face our temptations with intentional living. We must face our temptations with intentional living. See, the Corinthians were very comfortable in their culture. They were very secure in their way of life. But they were not purposeful about living in their world. How do we live in a Corinth? How do we live in America today? Are we aware of our temptations? Are we willing to make purposeful decisions so that we may not sin against God and harm the reputation of his gospel? Well, Paul gives us three ways. The first is to live purposefully. We find this in the first paragraph of our passage. Do you not know that in a race all the runners compete, only one receives the prize? Run so you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. Verse 26, I don't run aimlessly. I don't box as one beat in the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control. Now, this is a transitional passage because if you'll notice the verse right before this, verse 23, Paul is saying that I lay down my rights all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. So Paul's saying, look, for the sake of the extension of the gospel, I'll give up my right. I'll give up my right to eat as a Jew with Gentiles, to eat as a Gentile with Jews. I'll give those rights up. And it sounds very noble of him, but this passage makes a transition. Paul says, I have to live intentionally, not only for the sake of promoting the gospel among others, but for the sake of my own soul, lest after preaching to others, in verse 27, I myself should be disqualified. Once again, we are confronted with our rights. We are Americans. We love rights. We stand on our rights. We are willing to fight for our rights. We will argue for our rights. We have a Bill of Rights, which we cherish. So we've been trained. This is a part of our society. You fight for your rights. You get your rights. You have a right to many things that I find amazing. So we argue for our rights, and we fight for our rights, and we protect our rights. And what we fail to recognize is that often hidden behind our rights, hidden behind our rights are our temptations. You know, a lot of times we're arguing for rights. What we're really arguing for is, I like my temptations. I like them. They're nice and they're hidden. They don't look that bad. And I'd like to keep them for myself. Of course, we would never say that. We're too smart for that. But I think that's a reality in our lives. I think it's a reality that we enjoy flirting with sin. And if we are not aware, if we're not living purposefully, if we're not living intentionally, we can be sucked into all kinds of problems. I want to illustrate from my own life. I love to read the news. I started reading the newspaper when I was a boy. My home was filled with newspapers. I've always loved the news. And then I discovered that you can read the news on the internet. You can read news from all over the English-speaking world. Wow. How fun. And I also love to read commentary on the news in blogs. I love to read. There are two blogs in particular written by Christians I would highly respect, and I love to read their commentary on the news. And so I began a habit of doing this. Often these blogs will have links to news articles and other blogs, and those sites have links to other sites. And, well, I've often found my way through them, and I end up reading blogs and articles that reflect very arrogant and unhelpful viewpoints that have nothing to do with the article or commentary I originally read. Sometimes these sites come with advertisements or photographs that I should not look at. Oh, I leave right away. I don't linger on them. But I found that I was spending increasing time surfing blogs like this and increasing time flirting with this cherished temptation. My conscience was bothering me, so I brought it up to the men in my care group, Corby and Greg. This is what's so sad. My conscience was bothering me and I brought it up only to defend my right. I think I'd be a little more sophisticated than that, but I wasn't. And so they're drawing me out on this and asking me very specific questions. And as they're drawing me out, I'm saying, well, you know, I mean, as a pastor, it's important to be kind of aware of what's going on and what people are saying, you know, and what unbelievers think. And I'm defending myself. And they helped me. They helped me to see that when I went beyond the original story and started surfing, I wasn't really trying to learn. But I was fascinated with the sinful viewpoints that were shared. And I harbored in my heart a hope that I would run into a picture that I would never search for, but look at ever so quickly. They suggested that I put self-imposed limits on my reading rights. It took some persuading, I'm sorry to say. But what they said really helped me. They said, John, you are not mature enough to do this. Ouch. It's true. They said, you are flirting with temptation. In effect, they said, John, your right could ruin you. See, defending our rights can be a thinly veiled justification for flirting with sin. So all the while I'm protecting my rights box, in effect, what I'm protecting is my right to walk up to a line of sin. And oh, by God's grace, I had enough of an awareness to ask them and to be warned. And so I've made changes. I've made changes because I am aware, I am very aware of verse 27, that after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. See, training as an athlete, which this passage talks about, means that you live with one purpose. You live to win the race. Look at verse 25. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. See, top athletes, they put themselves on strict diets. They have strict sleep schedules. They have strict training regimens. They live their lives around their sports, everything, family life, everything, work. It's all built around winning. They have a prize in sight. They are training to be first place. We don't study the training habits of the guy who always comes in fifth. You know, he's the one I want to see. Now, we look for the first place guy. We find out about his fanatical habits. And we say, that is amazing. The level of discipline in his life. Paul says, as we consider the world we live in and the importance of the gospel and our position as representatives of the gospel and our proneness to disqualify ourselves, we should be training the same way. We should be training like the first place guy. Athletes don't make life hard for themselves as if the hardship is what makes them excellent. They are very purposeful. They are not aimless in their self-control. Their training is specifically targeted. Every activity has a specific purpose. That means if I'm going to be purposeful in my internet habits, I can't just make any change. I can't say, oh, you know, I've been so undisciplined with my news reading. I'm going to go on the South Beach diet. I think that'll take care of it. Well, that's stupid. That's aimless. Or maybe I'd say, maybe a little closer, I would say, you know, I really need to get a grip on this, so I'm just not going to go on the internet for 1 month. Well, a month later, I'll be no different. I need to be very specific and very purposeful in my pursuit of sanctification. I need to be purposeful in light of the temptation that can attack me. I need to go after that temptation and not just any temptation. It's not about asceticism. It's about targeting the problem to put it to death. And I have made changes, and my friends follow up, and I am very grateful. If you want to finish the race, you're going to have purposeful self-control. You're going to have to live like an athlete. Now, there's a second way that Paul points out that we can avoid temptation and its destructive power, and that is to live humbly. Look at chapter 10, the first five voices. First five verses. Whew. I want you to know, brothers, our fathers were all under the cloud, all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. In other words, when the Israelites left Egypt, God led them into the wilderness under a cloud. The glory of God went ahead of the nation as they traveled. They didn't need a road map. They followed the cloud. When they got to the Red Sea, you know the story. The Egyptians are coming to destroy them. God opens the waters and they escape through those waters. And he says it's like they were baptized into Moses. All ate the same spiritual food. That was the manna God provided in the wilderness. All drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank from the same spiritual rock that followed them. The rock was Christ. Again, Moses, God commands Moses, strike this rock, water will come gushing out, or the people will die of thirst. And throughout their wilderness journey, they are constantly given this water in the desert to provide for the nation. And Paul is saying, Christ was there. He was doing that for them. And what he's saying to the Corinthians is, he's doing that for you as well. For he has provided you with your baptism into Christ. And he has provided you with the bread and the wine representing his body and blood. He has given you those rivers of living water that will flow out of your inmost being when you put your faith in him. So Paul's being very careful to say, look, you Corinthians, you are not any different. You are no different from the Israelites. And look at verse 5. Nevertheless, with most of them, God was not pleased. For they were overthrown in the wilderness. With most of them, that's rather generous. Actually, only two from that generation made it out of the wilderness, Joshua and Caleb. All the rest were overthrown. All the rest failed. Another generation had to enter the promised land. The fathers who saw the miracles, the Red Sea parting, the miracles in Egypt, did not enter into the promised land. These are to be examples. Look at verse 6. These took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. And then verse 7 recounts another story from the wilderness journey. This is right after Moses gets the Ten Commandments. He goes up on the mountain. The people are terrified. God's presence is revealed in smoke and thunder and earthquakes. Goes up to the mountain, comes back, gives them the Ten Commandments, gives them the law of God. Then God calls them back up the mountain. And while Moses is gone, people say, you know, in Egypt, all the gods had representations, idols. We don't know who is the Lord. So Aaron arranges to make a calf idol. He said, here's your God. And the people have a pagan festival. They sacrifice to this calf idol and they have a meal. And he quotes directly from Exodus chapter 32. It says that people sat down in verse 7 to eat and drink and rose up to play. That is clearly a reference to the sexual habits that and practices that would go with these festivals. What's he telling the Corinthians? You're no better than your forefathers. What's he telling us? We're no better than the Corinthians. And if we don't live purposefully in the face of temptation, we'll face a similar outcome. Verse 8 gets worse. It's a reference to Numbers 25. There was a situation. Israel is at a later stage in their wilderness journey, and these women from Moab come and invite them to a festival. Many in the nation join them, and it ends up the same way. They have a meal, they make the sacrifices to the Moabite gods, and they end up in practicing fornication with these women as a part of the religious rite. Verses 9 and 10 refer to other wilderness events that led to God's judgment. Now, I've read the Old Testament much. I love the Old Testament, and I have tended to read it with a degree of condescension. I have read it and said, "Stupid Israelites! What were you thinking? The Red Sea, man, didn't that make an impression on you? The water out of the rock? What's wrong with you guys?" We can read the book of Corinthians and we can say, "Stupid Corinthians. Did they realize they've been baptized? They take communion. They remember the body and blood of Christ given for the remission of their sins. What were they thinking? They've been given the gift of the Holy Spirit. Why would they want to go anywhere near an idol temple?" Paul says to them, these things happened as an example. I'm reading verse 11. "But they were written down for our instruction, on whom the end of the ages has come." The end of the ages has come. Everything about Israel was only preparing us to receive the real deal. And that is Jesus Christ, the Son of God, crucified on our behalf, risen from the dead so that he can give us the gift of his Holy Spirit, so that the Spirit of God himself resides within us. The end of the ages has come upon us. So take warning. You are no better than your forefathers. We have no excuse. We must be humble before history. We must read history and say, I'm no better than Aaron. I'm no better than the Corinthians. We don't have to look beyond Israel. We can look at the world we live in. We can look at within our own church, those we have known who have flirted with sin and suddenly find themselves caught, suddenly find themselves in a place they never imagined they could go. So we must be humble. Verse 12. "Think you stand? Take heed, lest you fall." I have found the Christians who live the most free from sin are the ones who are most aware of their vulnerability. They are humble. They are suspicious of themselves. They are quick to bring their temptations to God. And when their temptations persist, they are quick to go to others for counsel, for accountability, and for prayer. Humility demands that we identify the idol feasts in our lives. I think it's highly unlikely there could be someone from a far part of the world who is tempted to go to idol festivals, but it's unlikely anybody here is wondering what they're going to do this afternoon. And, you know, I've got an invitation to this dinner. They're going to make a sacrifice to an idol, but okay, that's not our problem. But you know what? We have temptations that are the same thing. Things that look so socially acceptable. It's the norm. I have a right to this. What are you telling me? I can't read the news on the internet? I shared with you my right to follow the news and the blogs. The Corinthians would argue, we need to be educated as to how we think. Everybody reads the news. You have to be up on the news. It's only a computer screen with lights on it. I have a right to read. Josh was telling me about someone he interacted with last week. Said she'd invited a friend to Alpha. And the friend was touched by the invitation and said, "Great, let's go to Alpha and why don't you come clubbing with me? We'll go out together." She wanted to know how she would respond because she was uncomfortable doing this. Well, a Corinthian would argue, "Why are you so legalistic? I won't get drunk. I'll be careful who I dance with. I have a right to these things. What's wrong with it?" And It's for the purpose of evangelism. I was talking to someone else this week. She told me how her family, her unbelieving family, pressures her to join them in watching movies that would be sexually tempting. Now, a Corinthian would argue, come on, it's my family. I'm trying to reach them for the Lord. I want them to know I accept them as they are. I don't want them to think that I think I'm superior to them. And I'll close my eyes at the really bad parts. Okay? That's how a Corinthian thinks about temptation. Now, if you've been following Paul, as I was studying this, there was a point in my study where I became afraid for myself. Because I realized Paul is saying, you're no better than the Israelites. You're no better than the Corinthians. Who is up to this? Which one of us can say, through self-control and humility, I will avoid sin? I can't say that. I can't say that. Can't. And that really leads us to our final point. The third way to avoid temptation is to live dependently. Look at verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond your ability, but with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. Where does our confidence lie in the face of temptation? At the end of the day, self-control will not keep me, nor will simply being humble. I need help that goes beyond myself. I need God. I need His power, and His promises are bound up in His character. God is faithful. God will be faithful to me. God will be faithful to me in my temptation. He will provide me with a way of escape. He will provide me with ability. He will providentially arrange the circumstances so they are not overwhelming to me. He'll keep my temptations within the limits of the power that He has given me by His Spirit. He's overseeing my temptations. He's watching me. He's not intending that I should fail. God has promised to be faithful to you and me in our temptation. The question this passage asks us is, will you be faithful to God and control your life and humble yourself in the face of temptation? You see, our walk with God, it's a participatory joint effort. He provides the power. He provides the circumstances. He provides the endurance, but we must cooperate. And that means we've got to be very purposeful and very intentional about how we live, especially in light of our temptations. If we are not, we cannot be confident in His promises because we are walking outside the sphere of grace He's provided us in those promises. So He promises to be faithful, to do three things. You'll notice in this passage, He promises to give you grace not to give in to the temptation. He promises the temptation will not be beyond your ability. He promises He'll control the strength of the test. Secondly, He promises He will give you an avenue of escape so that you're not trapped. We can never say as a Christian, I had to do it. There was no other way out. There's always another way out. He provides that. He promises to provide that. Number three, He will give you the power to endure as you experience its pressure. Power to endure. Isn't it odd? He says, He'll give you an escape so you can endure. What's Paul saying? The Christian life is a fight. If you live your life thinking, well, if I just get beyond this sin, if I can just figure this out, well, then everything will be easy. There's an easy day coming. It's called the resurrection day of the Lord. In the meantime, you got to be a fighter. We need to stop fighting for our rights. We need to start fighting for sanctification. We need to start fighting for the gospel. We need to start fighting for pleasing God. That's the fight we're in. That's what God calls us to. It's hard. It requires endurance. It requires faith. It requires being humble. It requires going to care group and saying, you know, my conscience has been bothering me a little bit. And to have your friends ask you 10 questions and suddenly your little bothered conscience is majorly bothered. That's what we need. It's how we live. We've got the problem of enemies without. We've got the movies, we've got the blogs, we've got the parties, we've got the clubbing or whatever it might be. Those are the enemies without. We also have the enemies within. Oh, my heart wants to believe that what the world promises will deliver. But it does not. So we've got to fight. And as we fight, we need to remember God is faithful. If I don't live dependent on His faithfulness, I will give up the fight. I must count on Him to be faithful and to do my part. Now, I'm going to conclude in just a moment, but I want to, this is very important, I want to speak to those of you here today who may not be Christians. You may not have put your faith in Jesus and submitted your life to Him. You may be young, you may be old. And you could hear this message and just feel like, you know, this is just the thinking of two rather uptight middle-aged guys past their prime, that being Paul and me. But it's not about rules and regulations. You see, when God created us, He created a law to serve us so that we could enjoy His creation to the fullest, so that we could come into the blessedness that He promised in creation. But we rebelled against Him. We decided we could find a better way. We left His law, and it led to serious consequences. The most serious consequence is being under the condemnation of God Himself, requiring payment for our rebellion. And then He sent His Son Jesus to live the life of a man who lived in the blessedness of God despite living in such a sinful world. And this Jesus died in our place so that our penalty for sin could be paid. And then He gave us a new law, a law that dwells within our hearts. And that law leads us to live according to the created order that He made so we can live in His blessing and His goodness. No, this is not about legalism. This is not about simply looking good to the world. This is not simply about not being a hypocrite, as serious as that is. It's about living in the goodness of God. It's about rejecting the lies of this world, of Satan, of our own hearts. That's what this passage is about. Live purposefully, you will live well. Live humbly, you will live in the goodness of God. Live dependent, and you will find whatever circumstance you find yourself in. God is faithful. God is faithful, and He will not allow you to be tempted beyond your ability. He will give you a pathway of escape. He will give you power to endure. He is Lord, and we can be very secure in that.